Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Sam Barker. And coming up, stock markets around the world saw huge falls this week. A sign of more trouble ahead, or just a storm in a teacup? Simon takes a look at what's behind it all. Also today, Sam takes aim at sky-high car insurance premiums and rip-off broadband price rises. Also today, reader question time. I'm going to be made redundant. What do I do with the money, and can I cut my tax bill? And are we about to see a fresh mortgage rate battle? Don't forget, you stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.
But first, global stock markets had a torrid start to the week. Japan's Nikkei fell 12% on Monday. $100 billion was wiped off Australia's share market value. The tech-heavy US NASDAQ index opened 6.3% lower. And the FTSE 100, well, that nosedived as well, as did others around the world. I could go on. Much of the ground, though, was made up the following day, but it's left investors wondering whether they need to strap in for a bumpy ride ahead, run for the hills, or if it's all just much ado about nothing. Simon Lambert, welcome. Sam, welcome. But Simon, to you first. It's been a bit of a weird time of late. What has happened?
A number of things converged to create a manic Monday sell-off this week. Firstly, there were some slightly disappointing US jobs figures on Friday afternoon. There is a US jobs report that comes out on regular occasion, and it's a keenly watched indicator for the US economy, and the stock market tends to react. Figures move around. The US jobs figures do tend to move around quite a lot. Investors read too much into them, what they want into them, the opposite of what they want into them on regular occasion. And actually, over the last, how many years in are we now since the financial crisis? They've even become this sort of weird bellwether where if the jobs come in too strong, markets can fall because then they think that interest rates either won't be cut or might go up, and they don't want them to go up. If the jobs come in on point, that's seen as a good thing. If the jobs come in down, that's also seen as potentially a good thing because then it might mean that interest rates get cut or stay low. And if the jobs come in far too low, then people freak out a bit. So there was a little bit of a freak out over the US jobs and the fact and the idea that the US may not have pulled off this mythical soft landing that everybody talks about. The idea is that the Federal Reserve has raised interest rates very rapidly, like the Bank of England did, and that was going to cause a hard landing for the economy. And there was this soft landing, which was like trying to land a jumbo jet on a postage stamp. And the investment narrative is that maybe, just maybe, the Federal Reserve did manage to land the jumbo jet on the postage stamp. And then the narrative went out the window on Friday. Quickly, everyone went, oh no, hard landing. We haven't, it's going to be a US recession. At the same time as the Federal Reserve didn't cut interest rates last week. Now, the Federal Reserve wasn't actually expected to cut interest rates last week. It was more of a surprise that the Bank of England cut interest rates last week, which was kind of evened. You know, markets suggested 60%, but a lot of economists were saying, nah, not going to happen. It will be September. Federal Reserve, again, most people saying it will be September. But combined with the US jobs report, it was the Fed's behind the curve. They should have cut rates. We're going to go into recession. This is terrible. And there was a sell-off on Friday afternoon in the US. A sell-off of stocks which have gone up by a huge amount over the last 6 months to a year, and over the longer term than that as well. You've then got Japan. The Japanese yen has been appreciating, and this has led to the unwinding of something called the world's biggest carry trade. Carry trade is where you basically take assets or currency from one place and you park it in another. So you borrow in a low interest rate country, to fund investing in assets elsewhere that offer higher returns. At the most simple level, you borrow in Japan, where interest rates are still at rock bottom, and then you take your Japanese yen, you convert it to dollars, and you park it in a safe place in the US, and you just pick up the difference between the two because interest rates in the US were much higher. Bank of Japan raised interest rates, the yen appreciated, the large financial institutions, the hedge funds, the traders involved in this decided to rapidly unwind their carry trades, which involves basically selling off those US assets or pulling money out of the US, out of dollar currencies or other currencies, and quickly sticking it back into Japanese yen, paying off your loans. It doesn't have to be that everybody does all of this all in one go. It just has to be enough movement at the margins that it shifts markets. And this is also true of stock market sell-offs. Not everybody's selling shares. Most people are just doing nothing. They're doing the sensible thing. But enough stuff moving at the margins can tend to move markets. And also volumes are thin in the summer. So you do see these storms in August quite often. So we got US sell-off, Federal Reserve behind the curve. Oh no, hard landing on Friday. Unwinding of carry trade. Japanese stock market crashes on Monday morning. Everybody freaks out. Markets down substantially. But the FTSE was down nearly 3% at one point, and it closed the day down 2%. That's not actually that big a move. You know, in the context of historical stuff, you know, there was a point during the COVID times and, you know, some of the storms we've seen where, you know, there's always this question of, do we do a market story? How much does the market need to fall or rise by for us to do a market story? And at one point we'd set the bar at 2% because it was moving around so much. Generally the bar is 1%, but we'd set the bar at 2% at one point and it would only move by that much. So anyway, after Manic Monday came Turnaround Tuesday.
Nice.
Yeah, you can tell people in the investment industry aren't a little bit underemployed in August, can't you?
That's unfair. On holiday, surely.
Actually, that's unfair. Well, this is another phenomenon, actually, interestingly, about summer stock market storms. Oh. There is a case that has been put that they are worse and there is more volatility when a storm hits in summer because the more junior people are left in charge of the trading desks, whilst the more senior people are off holidaying somewhere very, very, very expensive for as long as is humanly possible. Whether that argument stands up, I'm not sure. I mean, I read an article about it, so it's obviously a thing. But yeah, so there is that thing. Anyway, we had Turnaround Tuesday. Market was up a lot yesterday. We're recording this on Thursday this week, just to let you know. Market was up a lot on Wednesday and market's down a bit today. So there you go. Storm has probably blown over, but might not have done. When this turbulence hits, it can blow in and out in a week, but it can last a while. You know, you could see the rest of the month of this.
Seems quite significant to be nothing. Do you know what I mean? How can it happen that something quite, you know, such heavy drop, and then you go, oh, the next day it's just fine.
It seems ridiculous.
Never mind. That's not a way to rule the world, is it?
Or finances. No. But markets overreact. People overreact even more. And the people who overreact the most tend to be individual investors. And we'll come on to that in a minute. But what you're seeing is still part of this readjustment to much higher interest rates. Now, there's talk that interest rates might come down, and they have done in the UK by a notch, but they're still way higher than they were. Take a look at the Bank of England publishes its interest rate chart on its website. And the line that goes up from 0.1% to where the base rate peaked at 5.25% is astonishing. We talk about the highly unusual and extreme, you know, rate cuts that came in the wake of the financial crisis as rates went all the way from 5% down to 0.5%. And you watch it, and it's just like a line just dropping, 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 dropping. But the rate rises is a line that does the opposite, going up, 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 up. And actually, it covers more ground. So even though we've now got to the point where interest rates have peaked and everyone's gone, oh, okay, yeah, well, we're handling this kind of higher interest rate thing, stuff is still filtering through. We talked about this last week, didn't we, when we talk about interest rates, is there is an argument that even the full effect of all those interest rate rises on consumers hasn't filtered through yet. Not everybody's had their mortgage go up. I mean, I've still got, what are we in August now? I've still got 10 months till mine goes up when my 5-year fix ends, and it's going to cost me a load of money. All across the economy, that's happening to people. Their fix ends, it goes up, it costs them a load of money. All of those effects have not filtered through. All of those effects have not filtered through on businesses yet. Business borrowing, you know, is way, way more expensive. Businesses are still adjusting to the much higher inflation that we've had. So even, and now we're adjusting to the, oh, rates are going to come down, but how much are they going to come down by? When are they going to come down? And there's so much hope and expectation pinned on it that it will lead to volatility. It is entirely understandable that if you have what has been effectively a very unstable financial situation over the past 2 years, that, you know, we're not out of the woods yet. How many metaphors did I mix in that?
Amazing. It was amazing. We should do a football podcast. Simon, you mentioned there about stocks that were hit the hardest. Tech, is it all over? The good times?
I think what you have to do is you have to put this in context for a start, right? So let's look at the S&P 500, the US benchmark index. That fell substantially, you know, Friday, Monday. It is still up 9.6%. This year, 9.6% is a good return, a good annual return in anybody's book. The chart doesn't look so pretty. It's taken a bit of a tumble. Yeah, you know, the index has fallen from about 5,600 down to 5,200, but it's still up a lot. If you look at the tech heavy NASDAQ, for example, which is the one that's taken as the, you know, the benchmark tech index in the US, again, that's up 9.7% this year. Now, that's in correction territory. That has fallen more than 10% from its market peak, but it's still up 9.7% this year. And then you look at something like Nvidia shares, which Nvidia has gone completely nuts, you know, in terms of its share price. Year to date, it's up 105%. I mean, that's astonishing. Over the last month, it's down 23%. But year to date, it's still up 105%. Over the past year, it's up 120%. Over 5 years, it's up 2,470%. Anything that goes up 2,470% over 5 years or 100% over 1 year is going to be volatile. That's just a reality. And that's now one of the world's biggest companies in the world's, you know, it is a dominant force in the world's biggest stock market. And if you look at those world's biggest companies now, Amazon, Apple, Facebook owner Meta, Nvidia, Tesla, those magnificent seven stocks, they are much more volatile than your old fashioned world's biggest company, like the oil giants or the energy giants or things like that, which have, you know, and even then, they can be quite volatile if something bad happens, but it tends to require something bad to happen. Whereas with Nvidia, with Amazon, with Facebook, with Tesla, with Apple, there is so much hope value pinned on these stocks that all it takes is one little bit of disappointing results or something like that, and they can take a quite substantial tumble. And arguably, there's very little diversification going on there. They don't all do the same thing. They are actually companies that all do different things. They get talked about as, you know, tech stocks, but they all do, most of them do very different things to each other. There's crossover, obviously. You know, Alphabet, for example, Google's owner, and Facebook, Meta, Facebook's owner, massive crossover in terms of they are essentially advertising businesses. But they've got other strings to their bows. But they will. They do tend to, you know, it's they're not. If you held seven very different companies, you would be not properly diversified, but you'd be well on your way to being diversified. You'd be halfway there, living on a prayer, right? If those seven companies were the magnificent seven, you're not diversified at all, because they have a tendency to all move in the same direction at once.
So, look, if you are an individual investor looking at all this, feeling rather nervous, what's the advice? Join your French and your Spanish counterparts, take August off, go to the beach, turn your phone off and chill. Is that the advice, Simon?
I like to think that there's French traders sitting there at lunch, which starts at midday and runs until 2 in the middle of their long summer holidays on the Med or the Southwest Coast. Yeah, glass of rose, pink wine, Goldie looking chain, Google it, watch the video. They pick up their phone. They see, you know, market's down 3%. Just go, boof. Shrug their shoulders and sip their rosé. That's what we should all do. I apologise to all French people listening for that.
Why? That's a compliment. I would love to have that idea of me having a rosé just going, boof, you know, deal with this in September. But no, what should you do?
Don't panic. I know that this sounds, it's such a platitude, isn't it? Don't panic. But sharp falls do worry investors, but corrections are entirely natural for markets. And some of those biggest falls in history, when you really properly zoom out, they fade into relative insignificance on the long-term stock market charts. And they do this particularly if you look at total returns and not just share prices. Total returns include dividends paid out and compounded. And when you look at that, they're just little blips, you know. If you just look at the share prices and you just look at the FTSE 100, it looks a bit like a roller coaster. But the FTSE 100 is not the world's greatest example of a sort of long-term performing stock market if you only look over the last 20 years. I wrote my column about this week. I checked my stocks and shares ISA on Friday morning last week before the freak out on Friday afternoon, and all was going pretty well. I was like, that's all right. Doesn't look too bad. You know, things are getting better. Monday afternoon, I had a quick look again. Things look considerably worse. I knew that they would look worse, and I knew I shouldn't look because obviously I was at work and we were covering all of this stuff. But I was like, I'm just going to see what's happened. And I was like, oh God, rubbish. But the first mistake was looking. The second mistake would have been doing something, right? So you shouldn't be looking at your portfolio constantly anyway. Even in the best of times, you're tempting fate, and don't do it like 2 days in a row when the market's in trouble. But any damage is only theoretical damage. I am a long-term investor. I consider my investing risk tolerance to be pretty high. I'm 100% invested in shares. Therefore, I should regularly expect days when my portfolio ends up down a couple of percent. And the problem is you look at the monetary value, and the monetary value of that was, you know, a few thousand pounds. And I was like, oh, God, you know, but you mustn't think, oh, great, I'm like a few thousand pounds poorer than I was the other day, because you weren't going to sell everything anyway. And so it only matters when you do sell it. And I'm trying to build my wealth long term. And what you should do is maybe think about it as an opportunity to buy more when it's on sale. There is always that nagging doubt, that voice in your head saying, but what if it's the big one? Maybe you should do something. You didn't avoid the falls on Friday and Monday, but maybe you could avoid the falls on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and so on. But then you run the risk of missing turnaround Tuesday. And if you're so concerned about this that you can't ignore that voice in your head, then do maybe acknowledge it and at a calmer time decide to dial down the risk in your portfolio, because if it is driving you so mad that you can't ignore that voice, then you're taking too much risk in your investment portfolio. And then I've got 6 tips here, basically. Do nothing. Okay. Not reacting to market sell-offs is usually the best course of action. Studies do show that investors repeatedly underperform the investments that they invest in because they manage to buy high and sell low. And if you're paying attention, you will realize that that sentence is the opposite way of the way you want to do things. Don't constantly check. As I said, it's for the long term. Don't check on a daily basis. You're asking for trouble. Acknowledge your emotions, greed and fear. They are the primary drivers of investing behavior and much behavior in life. They are only natural. Accept those feelings. Blame your inner caveman. But, you know, don't react to them. You can't control the fact that those feelings exist, but you can control whether and how you react to them. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. Another fantastic investing platitude. But investors are told to diversify for a reason. A diversified portfolio will still fall, but it can protect you from the worst when market storms arrive. And as I said, you know, diversification is not holding 10 companies that do similar things or all move in the same direction on regular occasion. Invest regularly and think long term. Regular monthly investing helps. The problem with lump sum investing is you put a lump sum in and then the market suddenly moves against you and you're like, oh no. If it moves for you, then it's great. But regular investing and just continuing to do it can certainly allay some of those nerves. And then be bold when others are fearful. As I said before, treat market falls as an opportunity to consider buying more investments at lower prices. Try to flip your thinking around. CBT yourself. Yeah. Think of it as the stock market being on sale rather than your investments being in a slump.
All right, then. Thank you very much, Simon. Sam, thank you for waiting so patiently. Now is your moment, though, because you've got a couple of articles where I think it's fair to say you can just get on your soapbox and have a bit of a rant. First one, car insurance. People won't have probably noticed that actually premiums have started to fall. The reason you won't notice because it's an absolute smidge compared to what they've gone up by, which is a whopping 48% since 2022. Near record highs. Sam, firstly, why have they gone up 48%?
Well, the car insurers would say, with some justification, that they've been forced to put up their prices because their costs have risen. The picture is a little bit murkier than that, but that's the kind of top level argument. So they would say, we're paying higher claims bills because we need to factor in things like longer repair times because modern cars are trickier to repair. There's a shortage of repair staff following Brexit, increased wages, increased energy bills, and so on. And the top level figures do suggest that insurers have been losing money on underwriting, which is an important point we'll come back to. They've been losing money on underwriting since they started putting their premiums up, ironically. So if you turn the clock back to before the pandemic, 2019, car insurance premiums were about £470 a year on average. For context, they're about £622 a year now, which factors in that 2% drop. Back in 2019, car insurers were by and large profitable. They made about 10p on every £1 that they had to pay in claims and costs, so they made money. In 2023, so the last full year of figures, when the average premium was well above £600 a year, they lost money. They actually lost about 13p on every pound. And that is the narrative that insurers like to push, you know. But that isn't the whole story. So some people in the motor insurance world think that the current level of car insurance premiums is actually not justified. Everyone agrees it had to go up. But the context is that ever since the invention of the price comparison website, car insurance has been a very low profit industry, what the insurers call a soft market. And there are people in the insurance world, even who work at insurers, who tell me that they think that they have now overcorrected these premiums in an attempt to finally conjure up a hard market where they all make a bit more money. There are also two kind of wildcard factors that play into this that push up insurer profits in a way that perhaps isn't reflected in rising premiums. You know, premiums should perhaps be a bit lower than they are, but they're not. So one is that insurers are finally making money on investment returns. So they normally make money in, well, basically three ways: on underwriting, so on judging kind of the individual risk and pricing it accordingly for the chance of someone making a claim. They make it through investment returns, because obviously they sit on astronomical sums of money, which they then invest kind of in the time frame between you paying the premium and then that thing getting paid out in a claim to somebody, and they can save money on their own costs. Now, in the past, when premiums were low and profitability was low, investing returns were also low, and insurers were normally a little bit more relaxed about losing money on underwriting so long as they're making it up from somewhere. We're now in a situation where the biggest, most successful car insurers are making very, very chunky investing returns, which can make up half of their overall profit. And that figure is not shown in this headline figure that they like to talk about. You know, we're losing 13 pence in every pound. Well, yes, you are. But what about the investing returns? And the other thing is that insurers are paying far less money for bodily injury claims. So this is where someone is hurt in a car accident and the insurer pays out. These claims were once 30% of the average car insurance premium. That was 2 years ago. So almost a third of the cost of the average claim went on repairing people, not cars, and it was the single largest part of a car insurance premium. That has fallen by 50% in 2 years, largely because insurers lobbied the government to crack down on whiplash claims. We now have far fewer whiplash claims, but we also have far fewer bodily injury claims overall, because the system which had been put in place by insurers is so difficult to use that it turns a lot of people off. So where is this seen in car insurance premiums? It can't be, at least without access to insurers' figures, which only someone like a regulator could get. And the other thing which kind of suggests that premium perhaps could be a bit lower is that the average car insurance deal now is not the same product as it was before these prices began rising. At least the cheaper ones aren't. They've been hollowed out because insurers have been increasingly designing, marketing, selling car insurance policies that exclude a lot of things they used to cover as standard. So, for example, windscreen cover, lost keys, the cost of courtesy cars, which is enormous now. If you want that cover, you've got to pay extra. And if you have an accident and you haven't got that cover, then you're taking the hit for something which your insurance policy used to pay for. Car insurance premiums may tail off a bit more, but they're not showing any signs of falling significantly anytime soon. I think the market needs a full-scale review where a regulator gets tough on insurers to open their books and justify the level of car insurance premium increases, which they otherwise won't do because they can hide behind commercial sensitivity, and insurers don't really have to give an awful lot of their financials out. You know, their underwriting is a total black box. There's no way of looking into it. So there is some hope on the horizon. The immediate hope is that Labour are sharpening their knives for car insurance, and they've said that they do want to look at high premium levels. Now, I would argue that it's probably not top of Labour's agenda right now. Yeah. But it is something which that they are, in theory, very keen on in the lead up to the election. They said, we are going to look at this. So if there is any wrongdoing, hopefully they will find it. And I think if anyone has any hope of premiums falling soon, that's the horse we need to back.
We will get on to, actually, something that will be on Labour's priority list shortly. But just quickly, Sam, anything that we can do to cut the costs? If you say premiums are not going to fall anytime soon, anytime significantly soon, anything that we can do, obviously legally?
There are a few things. Unfortunately, there are fewer tools in the toolbox than there used to be. But still, the best thing you can do is to shop around. Be honest with the insurer. You know, don't try and manipulate your circumstances to try and conjure up a lower premium. But do shop around and do it on more than one price comparison website, because the things that you'll find is that you will get very different premiums for exactly the same car, depending on which price comparison website you use. It's not going to be hundreds of pounds different, but it might be £100 different. And that's simply because each price comparison website uses different questions. Take the time, you know, block out maybe an hour, a couple of hours, and just go through every single price comparison website. It's a bit of a pain, but so is paying, you know, £600 plus pounds a year for cover. So it's a big saving to be made potentially.
Right. When I said that we'd be talking about one of Labour's priorities, I won't actually be talking about it specifically, because also when I say that we're not a political podcast, we are not. We're a money podcast. So while the UK has been gripped by rioting in the past week, This Is Money has been looking at what your compensation rights are if your home or car gets damaged too, because that is what This Is Money is here for, to answer the questions you need to know. Simon.
I think most people would imagine that if their car or their house was just sitting there minding its own business and something really bad happened to it, that their insurer would pay out. I think they'd imagine that's one of the things that insurance was for. No fault of their own. If some mug sets fire to your car, then you would hope that your insurer would cover it. And you might find that in some instances your insurer would cover it, but in others they wouldn't. And some insurers will cover this stuff and some insurers won't. So for example, major car insurer Admiral, it's one of the biggest car insurers, will not pay out for damage from rioting or from other violence such as terrorism and war. Again, if you were unlucky enough to have your car or your home caught up in an act of terrorism, I think you'd probably hope that your insurer would pay out. And a spokesperson for the Association of British Insurers said, individuals, homeowners and businesses affected by the recent unrest will understandably be incredibly worried and distressed. Physical damage to homes or businesses is covered as standard by most household and business insurance policies. Most comprehensive motor insurance also includes cover for damage to your car. Insurers appreciate this is an incredibly stressful time and will be on hand to do everything they can to help customers as quickly as possible. Until, of course, you go and check your own car insurance and discover that, like an Admiral customer, you aren't covered. There are other ways of trying to claim the money back. So, for example, if your insurer won't pay for a rioting claim due to exclusions in your policy, you could file a compensation claim to your local police and crime commissioner. But all of that would take an inordinate amount of time. And you would probably think that it's the kind of thing where I need my car. My car is what I rely on to get around. My car is very expensive. It's one of the most expensive things I own. Oh, no, it's not covered. What on earth am I going to do now? And there will be unfortunate people in this situation.
What's the excuse for that? Because it's not an act of God. So why are they saying that they wouldn't? Sam, do you know?
I do know.
Good.
There are a few reasons. So the last big batch of rioting, which we had in this country, which was 2011, the situation with riot compensation was actually worse. It was much more complicated. And insurers, the reason that they were cagey and remain a little bit cagey about riot compensation, it's partly because an insurer will claim the money for any claims they pay for riot damage. They will claim it back from the police on the basis that this shouldn't have happened. If policing was tougher and more rigorous, the riot shouldn't have happened and that this was avoidable damage. Back in 2011, each individual police authority had to officially say, yes, there has been rioting in our area before they took any kind of claims from individuals or insurers. And that could take a long time. Some places would say this wasn't rioting, it was simple civil unrest, which is very little help for people whose, you know, car had been burnt out or their window's been smashed or whatever. After that, the whole thing got reformed. In 2016, there was a new bit of legislation which overruled the old legislation, which was from the 1800s, which was the Riot Act, which is where the expression, you know, reading someone the Riot Act comes from. It's that old. So insurers therefore had a little bit more comfort that if there was a sudden massive riot in one area and they're facing a lot of claims from one area, which they are very, very nervous about anyway, that they can more easily get the money back from the police. So what that led to was a system where more insurers did start to include cover for rioting. But as Simon says, they don't all, and some of the absolute largest ones still won't do it. So you can end up in this odd situation where, say, if a branch fell off a tree and smashed your car window by accident, your car insurer pays out. If a rioter takes the same branch off the same tree and smashes your car window, your insurer doesn't pay out. And in that situation, your port of call is the local police and crime commissioner, which was also a system set up after the 2011 riots. It's a slightly better system than we had back then, but it's still far from an ideal one.
Yes, quite. What can you do, Sam, if your insurer won't pay out? Is there anything that you can do?
The first thing to do would be to contact the police and sort of log it as a crime, which you would need to do before you contacted your insurer anyway. The next thing to do is to look up your local police and crime commissioner. You need to go online, and there is a system where you have to justify what has happened. You need to say, this was a riot, this is what's happened to my car, house, whatever it might be, and this is why I deserve compensation. If you need money very, very quickly, there is a kind of fast track system. I believe I'm right in saying that this system has not been used. So I actually don't know how effective it is or how quick it is. But the important thing is that you do act quickly, because you only have a 42-day window to file a claim. But yeah, the message is really, if your insurer won't pay out, the only port of call is going to be the police, and you need to get onto that as quickly as possible. The other thing to mention is that you can do that even if you are not insured. So say you have third-party car insurance, which is only going to pay out if you damage another car. You are still able to claim from the local PCC on the basis that, you know, this was potentially avoidable damage, and the police are therefore liable. Well, the taxpayer ultimately is liable for that.
All right then, Sam, while I have you, I have to say, you're not a good ranter. You need to get just a bit more angry, Sam. You know, you're a bit too fair, I think. But either way,
I need another cup of coffee, maybe.
Okay, We've got time if you want to go off, but maybe the broadband prices will get you going, because we had Lee touch on this last week. But this is your story. You've been speaking to Ofcom. Remind us of the scandal, Sam.
So I am actually very annoyed about this. In a nutshell, so we're entering a situation where the cheapest broadband deals are going to be rising in price by up to 14%. And the more expensive ones by as little as 2%. So what I would see is a hugely unfair situation with no apparent way out. You know, although there are a few, which I'll come on to. But the reason that I find this so shocking is that, and I think most kind of right-thinking people would, is that if the cheapest deals are going to be going up by the most, you know, who is more likely to go for the cheapest broadband deal? It could be individuals living alone. It could be people looking for a bargain. And largely, it's going to be people who are on the lowest incomes, who, you know, are happy to take the hit on broadband speed, etc., in order to pay as little as possible. Because, unfortunately, broadband is increasingly, you know, as becoming as important a utility as energy or heating, you know. So how on earth have we kind of conjured up this Dickensian system where the poorest pay more? The context for that is obviously we've already had 3 years of high price increases for broadband. So the average bill went up 14% in 2022, it went up 9% in 2023, and then it's gone up by roughly 6-8% this year. We haven't got the exact average yet. And the reason that this is all going to be changing again between now and 2025 is the way that price increases are worked out is changing. So in July of this year, the broadband regulator, Ofcom, said broadband and mobile. So this is the other thing, it's actually happening for mobile phones as well, but we've got a little bit less clarity on that at the moment. So broadband and mobile firms will no longer be able to put up their prices by linking to inflation and then charging 3.9% on top, which is what most of them do. Instead, they must increase their bills. It's got to be a flat fee, it's got to be displayed prominently, and it's got to be displayed in pounds and pence. That makes sense. What Ofcom didn't do was say that that increase had to be fair. You know, Ofcom appear not to have taken into account what a flat fee means to people on cheaper deals, which is that they will pay larger increases as a percentage, and that a lot of people on these cheaper deals are the least well off. So there's a system coming in where it's all signed off by the regulator, the poorest are being asked to pay bigger increases than the better off, which seems spectacularly unfair. And I make the kind of poll tax comparison here, where people, kind of regardless of their circumstances, are asked to pay the same bill. But it's not all on Ofcom's shoulders, because broadband firms need to shoulder some of the blame. You know, they are being, I would argue, greedy with how they set their prices. Their flat fees, whilst being easy to understand, are conveniently also quite high and put a lot of pressure on the poorest households. Three broadband firms so far have broken cover and said that their internet deals will be going up by £3 a month. So that's EE, PlusNet and TalkTalk. Three, another broadband network, says it will put its prices up by £2 a month, which they're very keen to say is less than all the rivals that have currently declared. But because Three's deals are typically lower cost to deals, that £2 a month basically works out at the same percentage increase as the £3 a month for the other firms. PlusNet, you know, they've got a deal which is £25.99 a month. It is PlusNet. That's one of their cheaper options. That will be going up in price by 11.5% with that £3 a month increase. At the top end of what PlusNet offers, very expensive, full fibre, very speedy internet, that currently costs £37.99 a month. That's going up by 7.8%. These are all very, very chunky increases. And Ofcom has no answer, really. I've put this to Ofcom and I've said, you know, what on earth is going on? How can this be okay? And they've basically come back and said, it's fine. We'll keep a watching brief. We'll rely on market competition to sort it out. And we think that the most important thing is that these rises are fair. And I agree that price rises should be fair. A lot of people were caught out by inflation-linked price rises. They had no idea it was coming and they thought it was unfair. So we've improved the clarity point. But I think that's a pretty cold comfort if your bill just seems to be going up by what could be an enormous amount, you know, and they just aren't interested. And I think a lot of people don't know it's coming, and they're only going to find out from about August of this year up till January, which is when that's really going to land, because past January, you're not allowed to use the old pricing system anymore. Now, the only way that you can avoid this is to, there are a couple of ways. So if you are on means-tested benefits, then you will be eligible for what's called a social tariff. So this is a kind of a no-frills broadband deal. These only exist because Ofcom, in one of its, you know, more generous moments, said that broadband firms have to have an answer for vulnerable customers. But the problem is that only 3% of people that are eligible for social tariffs actually have one, because broadband firms do not need to advertise them. And why would they? Because, you know, quite often they lose money. The important thing about social tariffs is that they do not rise in price during this contract. Talk, don't offer social tariffs. But if you pick up the phone to them and you say, I consider myself vulnerable, my circumstances have changed, or whatever it might be, they can pause any price rises that might apply to your account. And roughly, I think it's about just under a quarter of TalkTalk customers are in that position, bearing in mind TalkTalk is one of the kind of more competitive broadband networks. The other thing to do, if you think that price rises midterm are quite unfair, and you think that high price rises midterm are particularly unfair, is just to go to a company that doesn't offer them. You know, they just say, this is the price. The price is the price until the end of the deal, and then we might reset our prices. Okay. Unfortunately, there aren't a lot of firms that do that. It tends to be the smaller companies. Cuckoo is one, Ufiber is another, and there's probably about five that do this. Yeah, they're great companies, but they're not as big in reach or scope. You may not be able to get access to them depending on where you live in the country. So really, there isn't much avoiding this, and it just, yeah, so it makes me very annoyed.
That's it for part one.
I am joined now by Dan Beecroft of Charles Stanley Direct for our weekly Investing Explained feature. Dan, we've got a question here from a reader. How can I decide how much to save into my pension?
Well, it can be quite complex. So getting the help of a financial planner is advisable, but there are a few things that you could consider. So one, time frame. How long until retirement is on the cards? A longer time frame will mean you don't have to contribute as much, and you'll benefit from investment growth and compound interest. Two, what are your actual retirement goals? What sort of lifestyle are you looking to enjoy? So I speak with clients that have quite modest goals, but I also speak with clients that have aspirational dreams, so luxury holidays, fancy cars, a house in the country. If that's you, it's going to cost more, so you'll need to save more. And then I think affordability is the biggest hurdle for most. So how much can you actually afford to contribute? What sort of disposable income do you have each month? For many, they'll have a balancing act. So balancing short-term wants versus long-term needs. I think generally people are more concerned about pensions in their 40s. Retirement's an awful lot closer. And therefore they start to become anxious that they've not saved enough or that they're not contributing enough. It's not too late for them, but starting a pension pot younger means you're not playing catch up later on in life. And we have a popular rule of thumb, and that is the half your age rule. So this recommends you start saving a percentage of your gross salary equal to half your age when you start contributing to a pension. You then continue that same percentage for the rest of your working life, and you don't need to increase it. So an example would be a 20-year-old starting out. They'd need to contribute 10% of their salary every year until retirement, but a 40-year-old doing the same would need to contribute 20%. It's therefore way more affordable and achievable if you start younger.
And how can someone check that they're on track with their retirement savings?
So think about how much they'd need each year in retirement. You'll likely need less than you do in your working life, because you might have paid off your mortgage, you no longer have commuting costs. It varies, but I'd say 70% of pre-retirement income is a good figure to aim for. Then you need to be calculating, what have you already got saved? So identify all sources of retirement income. So if you qualify for the state pension, workplace pensions, personal pensions, you might have ISAs, investments, rental properties. Have an idea as to how much that would bring in, and then use retirement calculators. There are plenty of useful tools on the internet that will help project the value of your pension pots, and they'll calculate if there's a shortfall. If there is, they'll offer guidance on how much you should be contributing to get back on track. If things aren't on track, seem unrealistic or not achievable, seek financial advice.
Dan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Welcome back. Mortgage rates continued to fall this week as HSBC and Barclays became the latest lenders to cut the cost of home loans, HSB being the third lender to reintroduce a sub-4% five-year fixed deal following mortgage rate cuts by Nationwide and NatWest. Barclays also cut its lowest five-year fixed deal from 4.04% to 3.84%. Simon, do we have a mortgage battle on our hands, or am I just getting a bit carried away?
Yeah, we've got a mortgage battle on our hands. It's a bit of a mini battle, but it's a battle all the same. Mortgage lenders are in a position where one cuts and the other one cuts and then the other one cuts. So we had these great rates come in. And then Barclays also announced that from today, it's cutting its lowest five-year fixed rate deal from 4.04% to 3.84%. Now, all of these cuts are, they're not bad, right? We've seen 0.19% percentage point cuts. That's a 0.2 percentage point cut. That's pretty tasty. Not going to make a massive difference to people's monthly payments, in all honesty. Every little helps, as they say, but things are moving in the right direction. Obviously, you will notice that these are smaller than the base rate cut that was 0.25 percentage points the other day, but fixed rate mortgages and the base rate don't move in lockstep. You can't expect that to happen. And in fact, mortgage rates were already anticipating the base rate being cut and had already come down, in advance of it. So actually, it's pretty good that seeing as base rate was cut and a month ahead of what people thought it was going to be, that those interest rates have come down a bit further. Not everybody's going to get these rates. These are the rates for the absolute creme de la creme of mortgage borrowers, the one with the biggest deposits and the really good finances, etc. But your average borrower is going to be paying less than they were. And overall, for those people who are coming to the end of fixed rate deals, that is good news. Overall, for people who are looking at buying a home, that is good news. What we don't want is a scenario where house prices go bonkers again. Are they going to go bonkers from here? Are mortgage rates going to fall low enough for them to go a bit bonkers? Probably not. I mean, I think that mortgage rates are around the kind of 3 to 3.5% level are probably going to keep a cap on house prices, because there's a limit to how much people can borrow in that scenario without their salaries going up substantially. And whilst we have seen decent wage increases in recent years, we haven't seen anywhere near the wage increases that would get the house price to wages ratio back to normal. So overall, positive for borrowers. Not such good news for savers, though.
No. I got a notification today that my rate was dropping.
Yeah, it's an unfortunate byproduct of the Bank of England cutting the base rate that people get the savings rates chopped, and some of the really good ones got chopped immediately. I mean, one of the best ones, CHIPS, Easy Access Flexible Cash ISA, got a chop straight away because it tracks the Bank of England base rate. Our This Is Money analysis has found that at least 100 savings accounts have already had their rates cut or have been pulled from the market. And that goes across Easy Access, fixed rates, ISAs, lifetime ISAs. Things are settling down a little bit. You might find that if you go for what looks like a really good rate right now, that if it's an Easy Access variable rate, for example, that it's going to get the chop pretty soon. So, for example, if you look at Plum's website, Plum's cash ISA still pays 5.17%. That's what it paid before the base rate cut last week. CHIP, as I said, that got cut immediately. Zopa has cut its rate from 5.08% to 4.8%. Another one of the best, flexible cash ISAs. It's surely only a matter of time before Plum cuts their rate. There are still some fixed rate savings deals that if you're thinking of fixing your savings, it might be worth trying to jump into, because if you look at our fixed rate savings tables, again, we've seen a lot of cuts on the fixed rate savings tables, but there is still Union Bank of India up top paying 5.25%. And if I click through right now, it's the Union Bank of India's website. Union Bank of India tells me that it will still pay me 5.25% on a one-year fixed rate savings bond. So if you do want a one-year fixed rate savings bond and you act fast, you might still be able to get that rate. I mean, they could move the goalposts while you're waiting. Again, MBNA still offering a 5.15% one-year fixed rate savings account. If you went there and opened that today, you're going to get the 5.15%. You should do. I'd like to think you would do. I'd like to think they wouldn't move the goalposts mid-application. But yeah, I think if you want one of those best fixed rate savings accounts, it would pay to act fast.
One thing that we don't talk about so much, it would indeed, Simon, but I noticed it because I think this morning, I was trying to find it, can't find it. I think my bank advertised personal loan rates are going down. So if you do need a personal loan, that's also, I suppose, a thing. We focus on the savings and the mortgages, but there's also personal loans and other things.
And this is monetary policy in action. The idea is that by reducing interest rates, then banks and building societies will be encouraged to reduce the interest rates that they offer to consumers. Consumers will therefore be more inclined to borrow or more inclined to borrow a bit more. So you increase demand for borrowing and therefore you apply the accelerator on the economy. Whereas the other way around, by making borrowing more expensive, you hit the brake. But it's not a precise measure. It's not as simple as Andrew Bailey sitting there and just pushing his foot down on the accelerator at the Bank of England. Everything just goes whoosh.
No,
it takes time to filter through. And as we said earlier on the podcast, it's filtering through at the same time as the rate rises are still filtering through. So it's like going to one of those, you know, when you go to the beach or one of those places and you've got the waves are managing to move in both directions at the same time and then meeting each other.
Nice analogy. Like it, Simon. Right. Time is pressing. Reader question time. I'm due to be made redundant, hopefully not me, and will receive a payout of around £80,000. That softens the blow. I know the first £30,000 is tax-free. Could I put the rest into a pension to save on the amount of tax I pay? If so, could I also then take a 25% lump sum from this at age 55? I'm currently 52, and I'm a 40% rate taxpayer. So you've spoken to Dominic Trzynski, private client advisor at HFMC Wealth. What did Dominic have to say?
It is something that happens to people. You know, some people will go through it more than once. Some people will go through it never. But it's one of those things where it can involve being paid a substantial amount of money, more than you would normally get paid in a lump sum, possibly ever, or kind of inheritance style money. It can involve being paid nothing of the sort, and you might get unlucky and your employer just pays you statutory redundancy, which unfortunately is not particularly generous. Other employers, however, will quite often pay people substantially more money than that. And if you were a high earner, it can be quite a lot. So for in this instance, we've got someone who's going to get £80,000. Now, there's two ways of thinking about redundancy payments. At one end of the spectrum, you've got this is going to cover me while I find a job and I'm going to live off it way of thinking. And at the other end, you've got, very large sum of money. I need to make the absolute most of this and ideally add all of it to my savings or investments way of thinking. And then and that's a spectrum. It's not just you just do one or you do the other. You could be somewhere on that line. And I think it is important for people, if they are made redundant, to be realistic about how long it might take them to find another job, to be realistic about how long they might want to wait before they take another job. Many people will use redundancy as an opportunity to take a bit of a break from work. And no future employer is going to really begrudge someone if that's, you know, a month or two kind of thing. If there are big gaps in your CV of a couple of years where you go missing, if that you can't explain away, can be difficult. But if there's a bit of a gap between employment, it's easy to talk your way around. And actually, it can do people quite a lot of good because, you know, for those who haven't been made redundant, they might think, wow, the idea of 3 months off sounds absolutely amazing with a load of money to cover me. Woohoo! But for people who are being made redundant, even if they know they're good at their job and it's through no fault of their own and their business is suffering due to external factors that they have no control over whatsoever, it can be a massive knock to their confidence. And, you know, it can feel quite personal. So it's a difficult one to get your head around, and it's, you know, it's worth talking to people about how you feel about it and things like that. In terms of the money, it may actually be worth you talking to a financial advisor as well, because you are being presented with a very large sum of money, and what you do with it can make quite a big difference as to how much of that money that you get. So basically, typically the first £30,000 is tax-free, but any part of a lump sum redundancy payment that comes from salary, payment in lieu of notice, or holiday pay is taxed as earned income. Your employer should be able to confirm how this is broken down in its redundancy offer. What you want is your employer to give you as much money as is humanly possible within that £30,000 tax-free amount, because that's going to make a big difference. You know, there's an obvious difference between having 40% taken off something and having nothing taken off something. Then, if you're looking at the taxable portion, the answer to the question says you could put the taxable portion of the payment into a pension to save tax if you have enough annual allowance remaining. You can include unused annual allowance from the previous 3 years, and it might be possible for your employer to let you do this through salary sacrifice, which would help you save on national insurance. So, for example, the annual allowance is £60,000 a year. It's highly unlikely most people will have paid that amount into their pension, although they might have done. You need to factor in that that includes the basic rate tax relief that automatically gets added. Okay, so it's not you can pay in 60,000 and then you get the tax relief on top of it. It's, you know, the amount you pay in plus the tax relief. But if you do pay that in, then that would make it effectively pretty much tax neutral on redundancy money over and above your tax-free £30,000. But you're going to have to wait to get at that money. 55 currently, and that's going up to 57 pretty soon in a couple of years' time. If you're over 55 now, or once you're over 55 or over 57, you could take 25% out of it as a tax-free pension lump sum, and then the rest would be taxed at your marginal tax rate when you take it out. There's some important questions that you need to ask yourself, okay, and do not just let there's this thing of like, don't let the tax tail wag the dog, or however they say it. Basically, don't just do stuff for tax reasons. What are your current expenses? Who is dependent on your income? If you've got quite a lot of expenses and an entire family dependent on you, and you're the only person working because your partner stays at home to look after the kids, there's obviously going to be quite a big impact of shoving a large amount of your redundancy payment into a pension that you can't get at. Are you going to continue to work? And how long is it going to take you to get another job? What is the job market like in your industry? Are you likely to get a job on the same money? Or are you likely to have to take a pay cut to get a job? Or are you willing to just take any job, even if it does involve a pay cut? Or could you even end up earning more? Do you have enough cash to support your expenditure for the next 12 months if something goes wrong? The worst case scenario, you don't get another job. The best case scenario, and I mean, I have friends who this has happened to before, is big payoff for redundancy, find another job almost immediately, manage to push back the other job to a few months' time, so that you've got notice, or you've got that you've got, you know, the gardening leave scenario, and then you start the new job on more money. So it can pay off, but it can easily go the other way, and you need to work on the basis of covering all eventualities. And again, if you're talking about £80,000, that is definitely the point where it'd be worth speaking to a financial advisor or an accountant or someone who can make sure that you do it right. Because once you've made a bad decision, you can't just go to the tax man and say, I didn't mean to do that. Can I just unwind all of that stuff so that I end up paying less tax? I mean, largely because you can't get through to them on the telephone, but also because they won't let you do that anyway.
Exactly. Right, Simon, finally, it's that time of the week. Well, it's become that time of the week. It's Simon's stat of the week. Is it a good one, Simon?
What proportion, in fact, of new cars this year are expected to be electric? Pure EVs.
7%.
No.
27%.
Higher. No, lower. I'm going to stop this game now because we could go on for a while. The Society of Motor Manufacturers and Traders, the SMMT, is expecting electric vehicles to make up 18.5% of new registrations by the end of 2024. That is down from its previous estimate, which was 19.8%, but it's as near as damn it to a fifth of new cars sold being electric, which is pretty impressive. does fall short of the previous Conservative government's target of 22% of vehicles to produce zero emissions this year. And if you go to This Is Money, you will find a story about how car makers are being hammered by the zero emission vehicle mandate, which means they can face a penalty of £15,000 for every car they sell that isn't electric if they don't sell enough of them. But anyway, the good news is nearly a fifth are electric. If so you consider that to be good news, 18.5%.
Simon's stat of the week. Right, that's it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. If you have any comments or questions for the team, anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
Email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk, tweet us at thisismoney, or come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Take control of your finances with Charles Stanley Direct. Invest, save, coach, or plan. Using technology where it's helpful and people where it matters. Our website and app make trading cost-effective and flexible. But we're more than just an online investment service. We're here for you regardless of your financial needs or if your life takes an unexpected turn. Your finances, your way. Take control today with Charles Stanley Direct. Sign up now.
Investment involves risk.